This year is not about Pesach. I figured the longer I can put off thinking about Pesach, the longer I don't feel guilty about not starting to clean yet. However, the topic does apply to Pesach the same way it applies to all the other mitzvot, which we'll get to shortly. There is an old joke that I'm sure everyone here has heard about a rabbi, a priest, and a minister who happens to be hanging out one day, as they always do in the jokes. And they were talking about the commandments of giving charity, tzedakah. So they had a little dialogue going on. How do you decide how much to give to tzedakah? So the priest says, well, you know, I draw a line, and I take my money, and I throw it down. I'm seeing some heads nodding. And whatever falls on the right side of the line belongs to me, and whatever falls on the left side of the line, they dedicate to God, I give it to charity. And the minister says, well, I draw a circle in the ground, and anything that falls inside of the circle belongs to me, and anything that falls outside of the circle, I dedicate to God, and I give it to charity. And the rabbi said, well, I do something a little different. See, I take my money and I throw it up to God in the heavens, and whatever he wants, he keeps, and the rest is mine. Thank you. It is a really old joke. Why is this joke a joke? I would say, why is it funny? I don't know if it's funny. What's going on here? So it seems like there's a tension, in a sense, that this joke is exploring, which is that the mitzvot that we have are physical acts that are supposed to somehow portray a spiritual idea. Meaning, we're doing this for God, right? But what we're doing for God is a very physical thing, money, right? The money belongs to God. What does that mean? God doesn't need money. Like, God doesn't have money, so how can God demand money from us? Shabbat. Right? And when you transfer it into a Bein Adam LaMakom, then the question gets a little bit sharper. Right? How can Hashem demand that we not work on Shabbat? Right? Hashem is all spiritual. What does Hashem know from work? Well, work has nothing to do with God in a certain sense. And all the mitzvot are like this. They are very, very physical actions that are supposed to portray or bring us to a higher spiritual plane or to new spiritual revelations. But at the end of the day, they are very, very physical acts that we do with our bodies. And this seems to be a tension that runs through all of Judaism. There's a physical and a spiritual plane that many things exist on, and there is a tension between them. And nobody feels that tension more perhaps than David HaMelech, who explores these ideas in Tehillim. But first I want to look a little bit at David's life and the portrayal of David through Sefer Shmuel, and to see how these traits appear in David himself. The first time we see David is in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet Zion, when he is anointed king. This is not on the beginning of the parak is not on the source sheet, but Hashem tells Shmuel, Shaul is over. His reign is over. I know that you felt so close to Shaul. You raised Shaul in a certain sense. He was your prodigy. But Shaul's time has passed, and now finish your mourning for Shaul and go and anoint another king. And Shmuel does not know where he's going. Hashem doesn't tell him. And Hashem leads him to the house of Yishai with his house full of boys. And Yishai, the proud father, lines up his kids, right? And if you don't think of Cinderella in the story, then we're missing something. Well, I don't know which one came first. But Yishai lines up his kids, and Shmuel sees David's oldest brother, Eliab, and he is handsome, and he's tall, and he looks just like he would be the king. And Shmuel says, Ach neged Hashem Mishicho, this must be the king. And Hashem turns to Shmuel and he says, don't look at his outside. Don't look at the way that he appears, because inside, he's rejected. He is a terrible person, and we see that about Eliab in the next parak, the way he speaks to David when David comes to visit him in the war. He's just absolutely obnoxious to David for no reason. We don't know it yet at the time, but Hashem tells Shmuel, I look at the insides of the person, and that's how I decide. So Shmuel then goes through all the children, and as they pass by, Hashem gives him a specific nebuah about each one. It's not this one, it's not this one, it's not this one. All the sons pass, and Shmuel says, well, I know the king is in this house, so you must have another son. And Yosef says, oh, well, yeah, well, I guess maybe it's David. You know, he sweeps the ashes next to the fireplace. David, he's in the back. He's a shepherd. Okay, I'll go get him. And David comes in, and Hashem tells Shmuel, this is the one I want to be the king. And Shmuel anoints David, and the pasuk says in pasuk Yadalid, and this is on the source, and source one, the ruach Hashem sarami in Shaul, uvatatu ruach ra'ami et Hashem. The Hashem gives David this ruach Hashem that used to be with Shaul. It transfers to David, and now David becomes the one in possession of the ruach Hashem. And that's the end of David's anointment story. And we don't really hear anything from David. We don't hear his voice. We don't see any of his actions. Things are done to him. It seems like he is this character that's caught up in a whirlwind, and the kingship is placed on him. The story then switches over to Shaul's palace. And we have, right after the Ruach Hashem leaves Shaul, we have the reaction from, how does this affect Shaul? Pasuk Tetzav. Right, I'm sorry, so Shaul has this Ruach Hashem, this Ruach Ra'ah from Hashem, and it causes him great psychological distress. Not exactly clear what it is, but he definitely becomes paranoid, he becomes somewhat dysfunctional, he's depressed. Shaul is in great psychological distress. Vayomru adei Shaul elav. So his servants turn to him and they say, Hineina Ruach Elokim Ra'ami Ba'atacha. We see that you have this Ruach Ra'ah from Hashem. Yomar na Adoneinu Abzecha Lefanecha Yivakshu Ish Yodea Menagim Vakinor Vaya Biyota Lecha Ruach Elokim Ra'ah V'negim V'yadol V'chol Lach. We have a solution. Let's find someone to play music for you. And when you feel so bad, then this person can play music and perhaps it can lift your mood. Vayomer Shaul Avdav Ru'una Li Ish Meitiv V'negim V'yadol V'chol. Go ahead, find me this person. There's this great guy, David, right in the house of Yishai. Let's get him. And that's what they do. David goes to Shaul, and the pasuk says that David stood before Shaul. They had this instant connection. David loved Shaul instantly, and he became part of his household. Shaul thinks to send a letter to Yishai saying, I want to keep David. I really like him. And as Shaul would feel this ruach ra'ah coming on, and David would play for him, and it would feel good to Shaul, it would bring comfort to him, and this ruach ra'ah would leave him. So this is David's introduction. What picture, so you just think in your mind, what picture we have of David at this point? So his occupation is that he's a minagim, right? Well, first his first occupation is that he's a ro'eh, he's a shepherd. His second occupation is that he's a minagim. He gets the melucha, he gets this ruach Hashem, and if you notice, there's a milah hamancha in this passage. Milah hamancha is a repeating word that kind of alerts us to a certain theme. And the milah hamancha, if anyone noticed it, there's a word that's repeating over and over, the word ruach. And Ruach always symbolizes this very close connection with Hashem, the Ruach HaKodesh that David uses to write the Tehillim. And the Ruach has left Shaul and gone to David, and there's an inverse parallel in terms of their standings. As Shaul goes down, David's star is rising, and it's symbolized by this Ruach Hashem. So the picture that we get of David from this passage is someone who's extremely spiritual, very, very connected with Hashem, very passive, in not a bad way, not in the negative sense of passivity, but somebody who never has to really do anything to achieve what he got. Meaning, Hashem, Shmuel just gave him the malucha. We don't know anything about his actions. He appears before Shaul. Shaul loves him so much that he wants David to stay with him. Vayahavehu, it says right away. We don't even see David doing anything. We don't see him playing. It doesn't even, I'm sure he did, but it doesn't say in the passage that he played for him first. So we have this picture of David as just this receiver of the gifts of Hashem. People love him. People, and probably because of the Ruach Hashem, people love him. He's an extremely spiritual person. Maybe just after. He's an extremely spiritual person. He's very close with Hashem, and people notice this. That's our impression of David from the first time that he's introduced. Then it switches over to the next parak, and the next parak is the story of David and Goliath, a very famous story in all of the words, David and Goliath. And we see David in this story in an extremely different light. First of all, you have the story of the Jews against the Plishtim. They're standing on opposite mountains. Again, I don't have the entire parak on the story sheet, so I'll just describe the beginning. They're standing on opposite mountains against each other, and the greatest warrior of the Plishtim goes down the mountain into the valley, stands in the valley, and announces to the Jews, "Somebody come out and fight me. Send me your greatest warrior, and I'll fight that warrior. And whoever one of us wins, that person, that nation will enslave the other nation. So if we Plishtim win, we will enslave the Jews, and if you win, if that person wins, then the Jews will enslave us." And it's clear that nobody is going to beat Goliath. He's about 9.5 feet tall. And he's this great warrior from his youth. He's wearing, the Pasuk describes, he's wearing tons and tons of armor. He is all set for war, and nobody's going to be able to beat him. And it's clear when he says, "Send me down a man to fight me," it's clear that he is referring to Shaul. Rashi even brings it up, "Berulachem ish," choose a man for yourself. The Rashi says this ish has to be Shaul. Why? Because Shaul, first of all, was the tallest person in the nation, so who's going to fight the giant? Maybe the tallest person, even though he had nothing on Goliath, but he's taller than everyone else, and Shaul was the leader. So if you're challenging the nation, the leader should be the one to step up. But Shaul does not step up for reasons that the Pasuk does not explain to us, probably because he was scared that he wouldn't win. The stakes were very, very high. If you lose this war, if you lose this battle, you lose the entire war, and you're fighting against an extreme warrior. So David comes to this battle scene, and he's sent from his father with food for his brothers. And as he gets to the battle scene, he hears about this Goliath who is challenging all the Jews, and he starts asking around, "Oh, well, you know, what's going on? What's the story? What did the king promise for the man who will kill Goliath?" And people are telling him, "Oh, well, you can marry the king's daughter and you get a lot of money." And he said, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." And Eliab, David's oldest brother, hears him kind of asking around, and he turns to him and he says, "You little twerp, I know why you're here. You don't fool me. You like violence. You like R-rated movies. You came to the war to see the killing. You want to see the blood. You're such an immature kid, David. You're so small. You're nothing. You like the war. You probably just left the sheep somewhere and lost them. Go home where you belong, basically, you little kid." David turns to him, and he says to Eliab, "What did I do?" You can imagine this conversation going on between two brothers. "What did I do to you? Well, why are you picking on me? Hello, Devarhu. This is out of nowhere. I don't deserve this." And then the conversation ends. And right after that, David goes and approaches Shaul and volunteers to fight Goliath. And this we have on the sheet. And I'm sorry, and Shaul turns to David and he says, "Are you kidding? You're going to be the one to fight the giant? You have no military experience. You're small. You're young. How are you going to fight the giant?" So Pasuk Lamed Daled, source 2, "Vayomer David al Shaul, ro'eh ha'ya'av zecha la'aviv bason, v'ha'ariv yatado v'nisatem ha'edah, v'yatzati acharav v'hiketi v'hitzalti mitiv v'yakam elai v'hachazati v'zekno v'hiketi v'hametiv." David said, "Well, you know, I do have military experience, even though it doesn't look like it, because one time I was a shepherd, and a lion came and a bear came and they stole one of the sheep. And I killed those fierce animals with my bare hands. I grabbed the beard of the animal and I was able to overcome the Ari, the lion, and the dove with my bare hands. Pasuk Lamed Vav, gam et ha'ari, gam et ha'dov, hikav d'cha, v'yachal plishti ha'arel hazeh ke'echad mehem, ki cheref marachot elokim chayim, and I'm going to kill Goliath the same way. V'yomer David, Hashem asher ha'filani miyad ha'ari u'miyad ha'dov, hu yafilani miyad ha'plishti hazeh, v'yomer Sha'ul ha'David, lech v'Hashem ye'emach, and Hashem is going to stop and says, Hashem will save me, and Sha'ul agrees, and he says, go. But he says, wait, in Pasuk Lamed Chat, V'yobash Sha'ul et David Madav V'natan Kova Nechoshet Avasho V'yobash Oto Shiryon V'yichkur David et Charbo Me'al Madav V'yoal Alecha Kilo Nisa. So Shaul says, wait, before you go, you need to wear armor. And he starts placing on David this heavy armor, right? The cap and the body suit and the sword. And David says, but David was not, he wasn't that kind of warrior. He didn't have experience with such heavy equipment. So David says to Shaul, "V'yomer David of Shaul, lo chal alecha be'elah, ki lo nisiti, v'yisareim David me'alav. V'kach makalo v'yado," so he just takes his stick, his slingshot, "v'yichalo chamishach chalukim v'nim min ha'nachal, v'yasem otam bakeli ha'ro'im asher lo," and puts those five stones in his little shepherd's pack. And then he goes and he meets Goliath. And Goliath comes to him in Pasuk Mem Aleph, and he says, he sees David, and he just starts laughing. Pasuk Mem Bet, Vayivet HaPlishti Vayiret David Vayivizayu, he starts making fun of him. Ki Hayanar Admonim Yafeinan, he's a kid. Vayomar HaPlishti El David HaKelav Anochi, you think I'm a dog? Ki Atabai Lai V'Makalot, you're coming to me with sticks? And he starts cursing out David. Vayomar HaPlishti El David L'chala V'etnat B'tzacha L'ofa Shemayim L'vamot HaTzadah, he starts trash talking him. Oh, come here, I'm going to go feed your animals. I'm going to go feed your flesh to the dogs and to the birds. Vayomar David El HaPlishti Atabai Lai V'cherev V'bachanit V'akidon V'anochi Ba'ilecha B'shem Hashem Tzokot Elokei Marachot Yisrael Shechei Rasta. You come to me with weapons and I come to you with the name of Hashem. And he says, Hashem is going to give me over into your hands, and at the end of Pasuk Mem Vav, Ve'edu kol ha'aretz ki yesh Elokim liYisrael, and everyone will know that the Bnei Yisrael have a God. Ve'edu kol ha'kal hazeh ki lo v'cherev v'chanit yoshia Hashem ki la'Hashem ha'melchama v'natan atzam bi'adenu, and everyone is going to know that it's not swords and it's not spears that save us, but rather all war belongs to God, and He is going to be the one who saves us. And then David does kill Goliath with a stone to his forehead. Goliath falls backwards immediately. He's dead. And David then cuts off his head, brings it to Shaul, and there's a great victory. The picture that we see of David from this parak is an extremely different picture than the one we saw from the parak before, and that's obvious. First of all, how does David act? Right? What's his personality? David is aggressive. David is confident. He stands up to his brothers. He stands up to Shaul. He stands up to Goliath, and it's a progression in terms of how hard it is to stand up to those people. David is progressively more confident, more aggressive. David is clever, right? He's able to figure out how to win the war. He says, "I can't use this armor. It's not good for me. I'm not used to it. It's going to hold me back. I know how I have to do it." Meaning, and what David does is he moves. David is very smart in terms of how he runs the war, because if David's not, he's not going to be able to fight Goliath on his own terms. Right? Goliath's much, much bigger than him. So if David comes to him with armor, he's just half Goliath's size, and they're trying to do the same thing, but Goliath's experienced and David's not experienced. So David knows there's going to be no way I'm going to be able to beat Goliath on his own terms. The only way I'll be able to do it is with my height and with my speed. If I'm not held down by anything, I can kind of dart around him. He won't even see me. And he uses the slingshot in order to be able to maintain his distance. So David is very, very smart in terms of his warfare. He's very aggressive. He's very confident. And the way that he earns the kingship is very different, because he earns the kingship through very conventional means, through warfare, through being a war hero, and through marriage, because now he's going to be able to marry the king's daughter, as opposed to the parak before, where David had to do nothing, and it was just placed on him as a gift. So from Parak Zion, the first Parak, we see David as almost a completely passive spiritual creature. And from Parak Yud Zion, we see David as a very, very active physical creature. And Robert also points out that it's important to portray David in this way, because David has these two sides. Because David is not a spiritual person, and he's not a physical person, but rather he is a combination of those two traits. David is a person who's able to have, to maintain these kind of contradictory sides at once. And actually, and therefore David needs two stories of introduction, in a sense, in order to portray that he's a very dialectical person. He's a two-sided person. Although actually, if you look inside each of his introductions, there is the other side portrayed as well. So in Parak Zion, where David is portrayed in a mostly spiritual way, there are hints of the fact that he is a physical person as well. And this we see when Shaul's servant introduces David. He says in Parak Zion, Pasuk Yud Chet, he says that David is Yodea Nagain, and then his second quality that he says about David is that he's a Gibor Chayil v'Ish Nochama. So definitely it comes up that David is not this passive spiritual person only, that he does have another side, but it's clearly not his main attribute. Second, and similarly in Parak Yud Zion, we very much see David's spiritual side as well. First, when David fights the war, and when David convinces Shaul to fight the war, he has these two reasons going on. Take a look in the beginning. Pasuk Lamadal. V'yomer David al Shaul, ru'eh hayav b'chal aviv batzon u'v'hariv yatadov. He's giving him his military explanation. Right? This is why I should be able to fight, because I killed these animals. Pasuk Lamadal. V'gam atariv, v'gam atadov, hikav b'chal, v'hayav plishti, ha'rel hazek ha'chal him, kicheras marachot elokim chayim. And that's how I'm going to do it. And then there's a samach. And what a samach means is a soap parak. Right? This is the end of a paragraph. The problem with the samach right here is that in Pasuk Lamed Zion, David is still talking. Why would the Tanakh put a stop in the middle of David's speech? And secondly, in Pasuk Lamed Zion, there's another Vayomer. Right? Vayomer David, David speaks again. So it seems like what the Tanakh is trying to alert us to is that there was a pause for there was a certain break in the action. David gave Shaul this whole speech, and Shaul perhaps was not convinced. Okay, so you did. Very nice. But you know what? So did 50 other of my warriors. I have great warriors in my army, and they're not worthy of fighting Shaul. So what makes you think that you can do it? And then David says again, Vayomer David, Asher hatilani miyad hari u'miyad hadov, hu yatilani miyad haprishti hazer. Then he gives his spiritual reason. But Hashem will help me. And then you see there's another samach in the middle of a pasuk, which is unusual. And there's another break. And it seems like Shaul is thinking over David's words. Vayomer Shaul el David leich b'Hashem ye'emach. And that's the reason that Shaul accepts. Leich b'Hashem ye'emach. Okay. I accept that, David. I accept that spiritual reason. And why does Shaul accept this reason of David? It seems like Shaul is replaying another scene in his own mind. And that's Shaul's own failure to be able to achieve what David has achieved. There was another battle on two mountains with a valley between them against the Plishtim. And this was a battle six prakim ago, between Shaul and the Plishtim, where Shmuel told Shaul, before you start the war, wait for me to bring a korban. And I can't imagine that Shaul does not have the sea flashing through his head where Shaul did bring the korban, because he was nervous that his army was going to desert him if he didn't start the war. He had to start the war. So he brings the korban, and then Shmuel comes to him, and he says, what did you do? I told you to wait for me. And Shaul says, but no, you don't understand. I did wait. I just didn't wait long enough. And my army was going to desert me. How can I win a war without an army? And Shmuel says, that's not the point, Shaul. You've just missed the boat. You don't win wars with an army. You win wars as with an army as a means, but you win wars if Hashem wants you to win the war. And I gave you strict instructions to wait for me with the korban, and you didn't wait for me. And Shaul must have that scene in his mind, because when David says, Hashem will allow me to win, Shaul recognizes that this is the person who is going to be able to give over to Bnei Israel the idea that Shaul was not able to give over to them, which is Hashem wins wars, not the army. The army is a means, but it's not the end. And that's why, in a certain sense, David, when he chooses his stones, right, David is working on two planes. It is the right way to fight Goliath in terms of physical means, to fight him with stones, because there is no other way for David to beat Shaul. And actually, I heard from Rabbi Alan Schwartz, who in a shir, he said that Goliath actually had something called gargantuanism disease. Kind of the opposite of being a dwarf is that you grow too large, and he said that the weakest place of a person who has this disease is right there in the forehead. There's no skull. Skull separates. So if you can hit a person right there, it'll go straight back to the brain and kill them instantaneously. And he proved this, that this is actually what happened by the fact that Goliath fell backwards. And had he not died instantaneously, because it's strange to die instantaneously from a stone to the heart, it might take a few seconds unless it goes straight to the brain. So he said that had he not died instantaneously, he probably would have staggered and tried to regain his balance, and then he would have fallen forward. The fact that he fell backwards means that he really did die instantaneously. So this really was the only way to kill Goliath. But David has that physical reason, but he also has that spiritual reason, that if I do it like this, if this is how I kill him, everyone will know. You can't kill Goliath with stones. That's crazy. It's Hashem who wins this war. And David tells that to Goliath in Pasuk Mem Vav and in Pasuk Mem Zayin. He repeats himself, it's Hashem who's winning this war. And we know that Bnei Israel are getting this message because we know earlier that Goliath announced his proclamation of the challenge in the valley, right? And there was something special. Actually, my father-in-law told me that he visited this valley with a tour, this specific place, and you actually can hear from the tops of the mountains to the valley. That's how Goliath was able to make his pronouncement, and everyone heard it. So everyone would have heard David as well when he said to Goliath over and over, it's Hashem who's winning this war, it's not me. So David is able to somehow combine his physical and his spiritual side. And yet, these sides are so strong in him. They are somewhat in conflict in him. And this we see expressed in Tehillim. When David writes Tehillim, he does express the conflict between these two sides. Take a look at Tehillim Parachet. You'll see how David struggles with these two sides of himself. Pasuk Aleph, Mamaseach HaGitit Mizmor LaDavid. Hashem Adonenu, Ma'adir Shemcha B'chol Ha'aretz Asher T'nahu Decha Al Hashamayim. Hashem, how glorious is your name in all the lands that you gave your glory unto the sky. Mipi Olalim V'yonkin Yisabet Te'oz L'man Te'orecha L'hashvid Al Yevim Mitnakim. Your majesty, your strength is established through little tiny infants, and it's against your enemies as a proof of your existence against your enemies. When I contemplate your name and the glory of your works and the stars and the moon that you established, I think, so what is man that you should even think about him? What is man's worth? He's so low, he's nothing. And yet, you made him just lower than God, and you crowned him with glory and honor. You made him the ruler over everything else, over all the world. The entire land is under his feet. So nevelafim kulam v'gam b'hem otzadai sipor shemayim utzkei hayam uverachot yamin, the sheep, the cows, all the other field animals, even the birds and the fish who are in the sky and the sea. Hashem Adonenu Ma'adir Shemcha V'chol Ha'aretz. Hashem our God, how wondrous is your name in all of the land. And if you think about it, you hear this perek and you really hear the tension. Has anyone noticed there's really a split in the perek? Although there is an Isgeret form where the first and last lines are the same, so it is a contemplation of that idea. Isgeret just means a framework. There is a contemplation of the idea of Hashem Adonenu Ma'adir Shem Chavokol Aretz, Hashem, how great is your name. So definitely the whole perek is discussing David's perspective on Hashem. There's two different ways that man relates to Hashem. In the first half, how does man relate to Hashem in the first half of the Mizmor? He contemplates the great works of God's name, and he sees how wondrous they are, how amazing they are, and he says, well then, I feel so small, I feel so lowly. And Rav Hirsch comments that, the Dat Mikra comments that this has to take place at night, because people are just more a little more vulnerable at night. They're more open to these ideas. And Rav Hirsch comments that it also has to take, we know it takes place at night because he's contemplating the moon and the stars. And Rav Hirsch says that in a sense, there's a cover taken off at night, that during the day there's like a blanket placed around the world, and we can't see beyond our own environment. But at night, that cover is lifted off, and man can contemplate the heavens, and he can see that there's just so much more out there beyond this world that I live in, beyond my immediate environment. I can look up, and I can see the stars that I can't see during the day. And it makes him feel very, very small to contemplate how much God did. I think that I've accomplished, but look up at the heavens. Look at the stars. They're infinitude. There's so many of them. I can't even see the boundaries. I don't know if there are boundaries. Other planets. I think my planet's important. There's other planets that are bigger than my planet, and there are planets that I don't even know about. Hashem, you are so great. Your majesty is so great. I can't even understand how great you are. And actually, Rabbi Avi Baumel, who's a teacher in Gush, he says that this whole Mizmor actually is in first person. As David is trying to figure out Hashem, he's really trying to figure out his relationship to Hashem. As he's trying to contemplate God's wonder, he can only do it through the prism of his own experience, and therefore the Mizmor has to be in first person. I see it. I'm trying in my mind to contemplate God's wonders, and yet it can only stay in my mind. It cannot grow larger than what my mind can hold. So even that is a limited experience of trying to contemplate God. And then he changes in the second half in Pasuk Vav, and he says, "But man is great. But there is greatness of man because you've endowed him with greatness. You made him just lower than God, and you made him a ruler. And therefore, man does have power. There is purpose to his existence. He is great. It's not just a mirage that I feel this way, but it's true. I do have excellence within me." And it seems like these two sides really match up perfectly with David's two sides. Right? The first side, half of the Mizmor, David's smallness, right, how he just feels so small in God's presence, really matches up with his role as a ro'eh, like the spiritual ro'eh who watches the sheep and meditates on God's existence and meditates on how great God is, and the composer of Tehillim who plays the harp, right, very spiritual, kind of passive, right, who just accepts God's role. And then you have David's clever side, his warrior side, his aggressive side, who says, no, but man can do things. Right? And this Mizmor is, in a sense, these sides in conflict. Well, which one is it? Who am I? Am I active? Am I passive? What is it? What's the right way to be? And let's skip over 4 and 5 for a second. But also, these sides relate very much to, the parak in general relates very much to Parsha Bereishit, right? It's also a contemplation of nature. Robert also comments that it's a retrospective on nature, whereas in nature we just kind of got the narrative. Here we have man's opinion about nature, how nature was created, and then he kind of looks back at it and thinks, well, now what's my place in it? But it is a very natural Mizmor, And these two sides of man very much match up with the Rav reading of Bereshit Aleph and Bereshit Bet, which are in conflict of each other, as expressing the two sides of man. Right? In Perek Aleph, man is described as Pru Urvu, man should multiply, you should fill the land and you should capture it. There's a certain dominion implied. Whereas in Perek Bet, man is a much more alone, he's levado, and he is endowed with the legacy la'avda'u l'shamra, to keep and watch the garden, a much more, in a sense, passive existence. And the Rav says that this is not, as some Bible critics would say, two different authors expressing, you know, their own opinion, but rather this is an examination of the two different sides of man. And we read through the words of the Rav, and for this I'm indebted to Dr. Shira Weiss for pointing me to this. As we read through this, think how well it matches up with the conflict that David expresses in Parashat. Adam 1, this is source 6, there's no doubt that the term image of God in the first account, and again this is Parak Aleph, refers to man's inner charismatic endowment as a creative being. Man's likeness to God expresses itself in man's striving and ability to become a creator. Adam 1, who is fashioned in the image of God, was blessed with a great drive for creative activity and immeasurable resources for the realization of this goal, the most astounding which is the intelligence, the human mind, capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings. Despite the boundless divine generosity providing man with many intellectual capabilities and interpretive perspective in his approach to reality, God, in imparting the blessing to Adam the first and giving him the mandate to subdue nature, directed Adam's attention to the functional and practical aspects of intelligence through which man is able to gain control of nature. Adam the first, right, Adam as presented in Perek Aleph, is striving to conquer the world, to understand it, to achieve, to create a physical reality that was not there before, to create scientific achievements, to do, to make things. Adam the first is interested in just a single aspect of reality and asks one question only: how does the cosmos function? I want to know how it works so that I can do things. He's not fascinated by the question, why does the cosmos function at all? Adam the first is overwhelmed by one quest, namely to harness and dominate the elemental natural forces and to put them at his disposal. His practical interest arouses his will to learn the secrets of nature. He's completely utilitarian as far as motivation, teleology, design, methodology are concerned. Right? Adam, as presented in Perek Aleph, wants to make things, and that's the man that's presented in the second half of the Mizmor. Right? I have control over the animals. I have control over the world. Hashem, you gave me control over the world. I want to do things. I want to make things with it. A man is obsessed, in a sense, with his own power. What can I do? What can I make? However, Adam the second is very different. While the cosmos provoked Adam the first to quest for power and control, thus making him ask the functional how question, Adam the second responds to the call of the cosmos by engaging in a very different cognitive gesture. He does not ask a single functional question. The second Adam, as presented, doesn't care about making things. While Adam 1 is dynamic and creative, Adam 2 is receptive and beholds the world in its original dimensions. He wants to see what is there. I want to understand how God made the world. Where can I see Hashem in the natural world? He looks for the image of God not in the mathematical formula or the natural relational law, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, in the stillness of the starlight evening. In a word, Adam 2 explores not the scientific abstract universe, but the irresistibly fascinating qualitative world where he establishes an intimate relation with God. Adam, as presented in Parashat, only cares about making a connection with Hashem. How can this world bring me to a closer relationship with Hashem? It's a much more submissive attitude, right? Well, Adam, much more than Adam the first, but in its incredibly submissive attitude, how can I see in nature the beauty of Hashem and submit myself to his law, to his rule, to in that relationship? And of course, these two people are prototypes, and nobody is only Adam the first or Adam the second, although people can kind of have those types of tendencies towards that. But the Rav says that actually we are, all of us are both of them. And we have to find a way, in a sense, to fuse those two sides of us, our much more physical, visceral side, and our much more spiritual, in tune with nature, in tune with God, the much more submissive side. Adam 1 and Adam 2, we have been describing both Adams typologically as though they were irreconcilable, separate persons with disparate temperaments and orientations. Actually, there is only one Adam with oscillating tendencies, because all of us go back and forth. The man of faith, in actuality, moves regularly between the faith community and the work community. He never remains totally immersed in the immediate awareness of being in God's presence. There is a continuous alternation between the cosmic and the covenantal, both areas willed and sanctioned by God, who wants man to live creatively in this world, even as he devoutly participates in the faith community. Adam 1 and Adam 2 are truly one person. In every one of us there abides the boldly creative and the devoutly submissive. Both tendencies are sanctioned by God. Rejection of either aspect of humanity is tantamount to rejection of the divine plan of creation. And everyone kind of has to find their own way in that. So where is my place using both my creativity and my religious submission? How can I fuse them, although they are in conflict with each other? What I wanted to offer, perhaps, are two answers of the Medrash. How can one kind of combine these in a certain sense? And obviously this is not an answer, this is just a way to think about it, because this question has no answer. Parachet stands alone as an embodiment of the struggle. But the Medrash does, it's very, very interesting in source 4 and 5, the Medrash takes very different approaches in kind of attempting to answer this struggle, and the Medrash puts these questions in the words not of man, but of the Malachim, which is very, very interesting that the Medrash does that. Let's take a look at the Bereishit Rabbah, source number 4. Rav Huna b'shem Rav Avahu Omer, b'da'at baro. Rav Huna says that Hashem created the world in a purposeful way. It was created with intelligence in the way that it was created. The world was created first man's food and then man himself. So the Malachim turn to Hashem and they say, they take the verse from the Mizmor and put it in the mouth of the Malachim, and he says, why are you doing this? Why are you creating this world for man? He's nothing. Why should you even create it? Amar Lahon, Hashem turns to them, and he says, Im kein toneva alafim kulam, again a quote from the Mizmor, so then all the animals, lama nivru, why did I create the rest of the world? Por shemayim udegei hayam lama nivru, why did I create the fish and the birds? Mashal amelch shehayalo migdam alei kotu, ve'ein lo orchim, the mashal to a king who had a tower filled with all good things, but no guests. Mahana Yeshlamel Shamalo, so what benefits do I have? What pleasure does it give me that I have all these things, but I have no one to share it with? Amrulafanav Ribbonosha Alam, Hashem Adoneinu, Madir Shem Chabachola Arts, Avid Madahanilah. Hashem, you are great, do what's good for you. Malachim, in a sense, don't accept this answer completely, but they accept, as do people, the sovereignty of Hashem. Hashem says, I needed to create man in order to appreciate the rest of my world, in order to recognize my creation of it. That's why man is necessary. Okay, keep that in mind. Let's look at the second one quickly and see how this measure takes a very opposite approach. Source number 5, the Gemara Shabbos. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, B'sha'a she'ala Moshe l'Marom, Amru malachei ha'sharet lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, so this is talking about a time when Moshe was getting the Torah. Moshe goes up to Shemayim, and he has a discussion with the Malachim. Malachim say to Hashem, Ribono Sholam, Mayu liyalot isha beinenu? Why is there a human being amongst us? Amar lahem makabel Torah ba. So Hashem said he came to get the Torah. Amru lefanav, Hamuda genuza sheganzalacha tesha meot v'shirin v'arva dorot, kodem shenivru'ah halam, atam evakesh li'tna lebatar v'dam? the toe, your greatest treasure that you've been keeping hidden for such a long time, you're going to give it to this guy? This is who you're going to give it to? And the implication being, maybe you should give it to us. We are much greater than man. What is man that you should be mindful of? He is nothing. Hashem, you are the one who is so great. How can you do this? Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe, hazir lahem tshuva. Answer them. So Moshe says, Amar lefanat Rebono Sholom, Torah she'atanotein li, ma ketivba, what's written in the Torah? So Hashem answers, Anochi Hashem lokecha she'oseiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim. I knew we'd get a Pesach reference in there. I am Hashem who took you out of Mitzrayim. Amar lahem. So Moshe turns to the Malachim. L'Mitzrayim yiratem. Were you ever in Mitzrayim? L'Paro hishtavatem. Were you ever slaves to Paro? Torah l'mate elachem. What's the Torah mean to you? It doesn't mean anything to you. Shuv ma'ksiva. What else is written in it? Lo yelach Elohim acherim. Don't have other gods. Bein hagoyim atem shurim. She'ovdim avodah zarah. Have you ever experienced the desire to do avodah zarah? Shuv ma'ksiva. Kaveh tzivichav yatimecha. Avaim yeshachem, on your parents. Do you have parents? Ma ketivba, lo tertach, lo tinaf, lo tignof, kina yesh b'necham, yitzahara yesh b'necham. Do you even have any desire to do anything bad? Miyad hodu lo lo, kadosh baruch hu shenamar, shem adoneinu ma'adir shem chavokhala aretz. And that's the second line in the Tehillim, the second time it's said. The malachim acquiesce and they say, correct, he does deserve it. What's the difference between these two midrashim? Or the agadata and the medrash? Right, so it seems like the first medrash is kind of taking the perspective of the first half of the medrash, of the mizmor. How so? Man's role in this world is to submit to God. If there was no man to recognize God's glory, then there would be no reason for the world. So therefore, man's role is a much more passive role, that he needs to just recognize God's being. He needs to recognize that the world was created in the way that it was created in order to see God, to have a connection with God, and to be the one that can say, Hashem made this world to me. The second, the Gemara, is concerned much more with man's ability, with what man can do. How is man different than the Malachim? Well, man has free choice. And man is able to do things because he cannot do them also. So man is physical, but the Torah demands physicality from us. The Torah demands the use of physicality to achieve a spiritual purpose, which gets me back to my joke about the rabbi, right? How can it be that the Torah commands us to be physical and spiritual at the same time, to take physical actions that have spiritual directions? Well, that's what the Gemara is talking about. Because only through the submission of physical actions towards spiritual purposes, only through elevating man's physicality and for spiritual goals, can a person, in a sense, merge these disparate sides of himself. The sides that are in conflict, I'm so small next to God, and yet God gave me so much power. The sides of my physicality and the spirituality that are really in conflict with each other, in a sense, can be merged through doing the mitzvot, through keeping the Torah. And I think that's what the Gemara is talking about, well, at least the second source is talking about, how we can take our physical actions and bring them to a spiritual plane and then create this quasi-physical spiritual action that feels like it's in conflict, but through the halacha it can merge together. The first approach is also using physicality and spirituality just by the nature of enjoying the physical world, of recognizing the physical world, of being a physical person. We can then recognize Hashem and create a relationship with him also towards the Adam 2 side, and the second one towards the Adam 1 side. And this again very much refers to the time period that we're in. So we're cleaning our house for Pesach, we're getting ready to sit at the Seder and tell Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim and do all of those physical actions that Pesach demands from us. And it's up to us to recognize the spirituality inherent within the mitzvot and inherent within each of our daily existence that David wants us to explore. Have a great day.